If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Ryan Fitzpatrick, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Neil Reynolds Podcast and episode 11 of our current season. As ever, at this stage of the podcast, I want to remind you all that you can watch this episode in full on NFL Game Pass as part of our partnership for the 2021 season. So just head over to NFLGamePass.com to sign up for free. This time out, we have an episode that was as difficult to record as it will be to listen to. Ryan Leaf's story is a sobering reminder that for all the success and glamour that can follow players in the NFL, there is also a darker side that can haunt some. Ryan was drafted by the San Diego Chargers in 1998, the same draft that saw Peyton Manning move to the Indianapolis Colts one pick ahead of him. But rather than their careers mirroring each other as the two superstar quarterbacks, they went separate ways. Manning is now a Hall of Famer, while Ryan Leaf retired aged just 26 with his life going to places nobody could ever have imagined. I've been privileged enough to get to know Ryan through his work with Sky Sports in recent weeks. He's been appearing as an expert pundit. I've got to know the man behind the headlines. And to put it simply, he's just a really nice person. And what you're about to hear doesn't necessarily represent the man I know now.
Thank you, Neil, for having me. I've loved getting to work with you at Sky Sports NFL. I love football. And yeah. It's probably the coolest job in the world to be able to sit down with you last Sunday and watch a great football game with a couple of great quarterbacks and all of it, and just talk about it. That's pretty special. I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah, we're very lucky to have you. So let's talk about football then, this game we love. And I wonder if you could tell me how much it was a part of your life growing up, you know, as a young kid and maybe playing high school football. And maybe when you think about what followed, was it a simpler time back then for you?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was just, I grew up in a small town in a small state, population wise, called Great Falls, Montana. I'm the only Montanan who's ever been drafted in the first round of the NFL draft. So there are more first round draft picks in the Manning family than the whole state of Montana ever.
Wow.
And, so I was unique, you know, and I loved to compete. And first time it would snow, I would be, and we had a football field in my backyard, essentially. It was just out past the alley, a middle school football field. And I would be out there running up and down, sweating like crazy in my sweats, playing football with myself. I just loved it. I loved everything about it. I loved the camaraderie, the leadership, the competition. And, if I probably could have played Pop Warner football, it didn't exist in Montana, as early as I could, I would have, but it was everything. And it wasn't just football either. Basketball was a huge part of my life, baseball, golf, everything. I love to compete, I think is the best way to put it. I competed at everything.
That's a good reminder, actually, that it's not all the same across the United States. I've done this podcast with a number of people. I ask that question a lot about how you grew up. And lots of people say, I played from six. I played at Pop Warner, but you didn't even have the opportunity. So you're watching it on Sundays and then you just got to go and kind of just make up games outside or in the street.
Yeah, it was many times it was just in the house, flying over the back of the couch, with fourth and goal, to get the touchdown. And we'd go to church, which was at 11 on Sundays, and the games kicked off at 11 a.m. Mountain time there. So we'd miss like the first half of the first games of the NFL. And I was just always so upset about that. But as soon as we got home, like the TV would go on, I would go into the bedroom, I'd put like wadded up socks underneath my shirt for shoulder pads, go put like 2 minutes on the timer on the microwave, and just run and run and run back and forth, diving over the couch and watching football. the rest of the day into Sunday night. And like nothing's changed except for the fact that I'm not running around now on Sundays, but my son is. So, you know, it's pretty fond memories of my household and football.
What about going into high school and college? When did you realize you were, you know, heading to become the star that you were? And did people around you change? Did you change? When did you kind of think, I'm going to make this and be in the NFL? Well,
yeah, people around me changed definitely because they could see what was coming. I still couldn't really see what was coming. I'd always had a goal, of course, to play professionally, whatever that looked like, whether it was a professional basketball player, baseball player, or football player. That was my goal. I didn't realize how difficult it was, or how the odds were stacked against me. So I just competed, and I usually came out on top is how it worked. And when I got recruited to play college football, I chose a place that I thought would help me be the best possible version of myself. And it ended up being the right choice. You know, I went to a place who had a great coaching staff, a great mentor, and who taught me how to play quarterback. And we accomplished something that hadn't been accomplished there in 67 years and winning a championship and playing in a Rose Bowl. And then before I knew it, people were telling me I was the best quarterback in the country and that I was going to be the first overall draft pick. And I was like, okay, yeah, that sounds about right. Let's go do it. And that was the mindset of how I went forward this sounded about right. You know, people were telling me how great I was. I was about to be drafted first or second overall. They were going to give me a ton of money. I was going to get endorsements and, you know, I was just going to play 15 to 18 years, win a couple Super Bowls, ride off into the sunset. That's how it's going to happen, you know, but you know, life isn't fair. No matter if you're the starting quarterback of an NFL football team or, you know, if you're working down at the local convenience store, it's, you know, life isn't fair. It's how you deal with it that matters.
So as Ryan says there, life isn't fair. No matter who you are, whatever your background, there comes a time when you suffer emotionally and physically. And after doing everything to put himself on the road to stardom, after seeing his life laid out before him, everything would change dramatically. But before it all did, Ryan entered the 1998 NFL draft in New York City alongside Peyton Manning as one of the sport's hottest properties coming out of college. But there was a difference. The headlines surrounding Manning were that he was going to work immediately and shape his career. For Ryan, the story goes that he was packing up and headed into Las Vegas for a week after being drafted by the San Diego Chargers. So did it really work out like that? Is there any truth to those stories that have followed him for all of these years?
There really wasn't too much story to it. It got embellished. The right. owner of the team, Dean Spanos and Alex Spanos, flew us back on their private jet. My father, my agent, and the owners. And we stopped in Vegas. And I flew my uncles and my best friends from Montana down and let them have a blast. You know, gave them all each some money, gamble. We hung out, we celebrated. And then I got on the plane the next morning and flew to San Diego to get to work. So the story has been, of course, embellished like anything else, that like Peyton grabbed the playbook and probably went back to his hotel and started studying. And Ryan went to Vegas.
Went on an all-nighter.
Yeah. And I didn't drink at all that night. I didn't do anything. I just hung out and took everything in with my family and my friends who weren't able to go to New York for the draft.
Did that get your back up when it came to the media almost immediately? And then that as a young man.
Well, it didn't play poorly at the time. It played like, this dude's awesome, right? He gets it. He's not this golden boy. When things went poorly, it was evidentiary proof for people to use in that narrative. And so I get it. I still love that night. I did something that no one had ever done and will ever do probably from the state of Montana. And I got to celebrate it with my family, people who had supported me and really carried me to that point. So yeah, I'll never regret that. That's a special night for me.
I saw the famous clip where Lee Steinberg asked you, is this hard or is this good, when Peyton Manning was called first? His name was called first. Was it hard or was it good?
It was good. You know, it was, we wanted that. We wanted to go to San Diego. I had family there. It was on the West Coast. It just felt right. I wasn't thinking about the right things. I wasn't thinking about Marshall Faulk in the backfield and Marvin Harrison. out on the perimeter. I was thinking more about the beach and the babes and the money and getting to play football, right? It didn't matter where I got to play football. I just, why not do it in an environmentally soothing place?
You're very honest. You don't shy away from this, do you, when you talk about it?
Well, I think I did for a long time, that buried me in terms of toxicity, right? Mm-hmm. It just built up in resentment and things like that inside me. And I know now that it doesn't cost me anything, to be honest, or to be self-deprecating. It doesn't mean I'm less of a man or a failure or anything like that. It doesn't mean any of that. It's just the truth. And, you know, the truth is hard sometimes, but it's freeing. Mm.
Your first two NFL games were wins. We've seen with rookie quarterbacks this year, that's not that easy. So was there a part of that where the young man living by the beach, you thought you were going to have the 15, 18 years. You come in, you win your first two games. You're like, yeah, this is part of the story. This is how it's supposed to be as well.
Yeah. I mean, rookie quarterback hadn't won his first two starts since 1983 in John Elway. So I was like,
good company.
And then Peyton had struggled really a ton out the gate, you know, and they hadn't won either game. And I was like, I'm winning this on every possible level you can imagine. But like any NFL rookie, you have your rookie moment, and I would have mine the next week, and it would define my career in the NFL. It would definitely do that. And it wasn't because necessarily of how I played. It was how I dealt with it. That was the reason.
Yeah, you're okay to talk. I mean, the game itself, you'd been in hospital, right? Before the game against Kansas City. So you've been in hospital. You went 1 of 15, 4 yards, 2 interceptions, 3 lost fumbles. But the bit that I think came, which you're talking about afterwards, was the bit which was caught on camera screaming at a reporter. Then you read the letter out that was written by the PA. I worked in PR. I know you
written by my dad. It was written by my dad.
Oh,
was it?
Okay. Oh, good. Yeah. Good. So that's good, because I thought it was written by the PR people. So that's good. But then you kind of threw it in the back of the locker. When I watched that, I'm like, well, that's not the guy I know now. And I wonder how you feel now you watch that back.
It's terribly embarrassing to watch that stuff. I mean, but I think most people who look back on maybe some petulant acts of behavior when they're younger are embarrassed by it. You know, I don't like how I treated that reporter. You know, I thought that the way for me to win was to be intimidating and show them who was boss. That's how I'd always taken care of stuff. I'm the big, strong football guy, right? I'm famous. You're a lowly reporter. What the hell do you know? I'm going to show you. And that's exactly what it showcased to the masses. Like, you know, people still to this day, like, dude, that dude yells at reporters. Remember that dude yelling at all those reporters? And I'm like, I yelled at one reporter.
Yeah. You know?
But that's who you become. It's a caricature of who you are. And then the next day, you're exactly right. Like, I did not want to read that apology. I didn't feel like I should apologize. And my dad, who's got perspective better than anybody, knew better, knew, hey, Ryan, you know, take some of responsibility. It doesn't matter what somebody else does. It's how you reacted, and you reacted horribly in front of the world. So take some ownership of it, apologize, and move on. And I just couldn't let it go, right? I resented that man. I resented my teammates and my ownership for not having my back. Those are the type of things that, and resentments just will kill you. It's like poison. And that's what I drank. I drank that poison for the entire next 2.5 years with the Chargers, until ultimately I was, not wanted or needed in that organization.
Now, while he would be the first to admit that many of the problems during his career were of his own making, there were some circumstances beyond Ryan's control, often beyond the control of all young quarterbacks. Being picked first or second in a draft, the reality is that you're joining a team that is rebuilding, and that situation didn't help Ryan's cause in the slightest as dealing with failure began to set in.
Well, the situation's always part of it. You get drafted high in the draft, you're probably going to a poor team, right? So our offensive line wasn't great. My skill position guys, you know, and this is not a knock on them, you know, a lot of them didn't spend much time in the NFL. So the longevity there is evidence of that. And then it was just me dealing with failure. Like, I didn't see failure as an opportunity to do it better the next time. I didn't. I saw it as a black and white issue. And if I wasn't a success, then I'm a failure. And that's how I attack things. And I wasn't going to allow anybody else to believe that. So I fought tooth and nail. And from Sunday to Sunday at that level, if you're not on point and focused, your central nervous system is just on tilt and you cannot function that way. I was as talented as anybody when it came to playing the position. Mm. You know, it was what you do from Sunday to Sunday. And I wasn't capable of doing that because that's life. That's leaving life. What you do on Sundays is just you play. Mm. And the guys that have real success don't think about it on Sundays. You know, Matthew Stafford, Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, you know, Peyton Manning, those guys, they don't think about anything on Sunday. It's just second nature. They're just reacting because they've done all the work the whole week. I was too busy putting out fires all week. I never had a chance to do the real work. And that was all because of the choices I made.
So you didn't necessarily shy away from the work, or you were just creating one firestorm after another.
That's one of the biggest misconceptions too. You know, it was like, my work ethic was shit, and it wasn't. Like, June Jones told a story my rookie year about how, you know, he'd never seen a rookie quarterback watch as much film as I did. And that was who I was in college too. I was a film junkie, right? I just couldn't get enough of it. When things started to go bad, especially with my teammates and things like that, I hated coming into the work. You know, when you hate going into work, you're not going to be productive ever. No one is. Going to work.
Right. In any job. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were on what, $5-6 million a year at that time, and just unhappy all your time, or were there moments you could sort of seek solace, or when you look back now, was that just a really, you just weren't happy in the NFL?
Yeah. I mean,
and it's a dream. It was what you wanted, wasn't it?
It's what I thought I wanted. Right. Yeah. Money changed me. I didn't think it would. I watched my father scrape and claw and make a life for our family, to a place where he became comfortable, and it never changed him. It never did. But I also think that generation, you know, somebody who goes to war, has a different perspective about everything, right?
Yep.
And our generations, will never have experienced that. I'll never do anything as important as my father did and have a true perspective until I've been humbled. And so I don't think that I was prepared for what was about to transpire, that I saw success as money, power, and prestige. And now I had it all, right? All the money you can imagine, the power that came with that, and the prestige of being a starting NFL quarterback was everything any of my peers ever wanted. So in my eyes, I was a success regardless of what I did on the football field. So, you know, I thought I had accomplished it. And that's the thing. When you get to the NFL, you have accomplished something that 99% of the population will never experience. Yet you're going to be judged on how you your legacy is with that 1%. And that's incredibly difficult when you're not able to do the things. Because, like, you know, there's only been 24,000 players ever to play in the NFL in 100 years of football. I mean, that number is startling. And I was terrible about compartmentalizing what other people thought of me. It was all my business. If somebody thought I was bad as a player or a human being, like, that hurt me to my core and got me angry about that. And so I behaved as such.
And then, so I look at this from the, you know, obviously from a long way away and from very much outside the circle. And when you say something like that, and then you're on the cover of Sports Illustrated just before the 2000 season, I don't think people were looking after you as well then, because with all of the stuff you'd been through, to put you on the cover with the headline "Back from the Brink," just 2 years after that, I don't know. Just to me, I'm just saying, it just felt like that doesn't look like the right thing to have done at that time.
But you know what? That's something I couldn't control.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't. You know, I figured that out later in life. Like, I control what I can control, but hey, like, I hate actually acquiescing to a lot of that, because I feel like now I would be using it as an excuse, like a way for me to take a little of the accountability back.
So you're very accountable to what happened.
Right.
You put it on yourself.
Yeah. If Sports Illustrated hadn't done that, I would have, you know, we're going to kind of flown under the radar that year, made a comeback, been this, that, and the other. You know, if the Chargers hadn't fired my head coach in week five, you know, if that reporter would have just been more respectful and not printed something that went out in the locker room, I wouldn't have yelled at him. Right. Like, none of that has anything to do with me. All that has to do with somebody else and something I can't control. It was how I reacted and how I dealt with stuff. So,
yep. Did you have any fun? Now when you think back, I remember that game in this place, or I remember that game. Are there sort of snippets of it?
It's rare, and it's weird because I can remember every play, every stat from college. I mean, anything. My memory is like lock and key with that. But the NFL, like, I will talk to former teammates and friends and things like that, and they'll bring up something in the game, whether it's positive or negative, and I just don't remember it. I mean, it's really something that I've worked with a therapist on, about post-traumatic stress disorder, where you actually push that out of your mind. And so that makes sense to me. But there are some, I mean, when you retire, the NFL gives you your highlights, because you know how much NFL films rights are. They give you your highlights and you're able to use them for whatever you want.
Okay.
And when I got those, I saw some of the great plays I made in the NFL. And I'm just like, I've been beat over the head so much by people telling me how horrible I was and what a bust I was, that I forgot like how talented and how fun playing in the NFL was at times.
We'll be back with more from Ryan Leaf on the Neil Reynolds podcast after this short break.
Hi there, Neil Reynolds podcast listener. I'm Yarick Zaba, and I'm here to tell you about another Highway 61 network series called Broadway to Brazil. Broadway to Brazil takes a close look at the Corinthian Casuals, a side that play in the seventh tier of English football, yet have one of the most rich and significant stories that the game has to offer. In our second series, we've uncovered a whole host of incredible stories, from the day the Brazilian icon Socrates pulled on the pink and brown casual shirt, to the story of Andrew Watson, the first black international footballer, via a bizarre tale of Soviet visitors at the end of the Cold War. All of this and more help to explain why the Corinthian Casuals are a far from typical non-league side. Find Broadway to Brazil on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Ryan Jensen, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
So, how are you enjoying the 2021 season? Have you been watching all the action on NFL Game Pass? Well, now some of that action is coming to London as the New York Jets face the Atlanta Falcons. Much is new for the Jets this season. They have a new head coach, a newly drafted quarterback, the new 17-game regular season schedule, and a new international stadium to play in for their fifth international game. Their hosts at London's Tottenham Hotspur Stadium will be the Atlanta Falcons. Now, having met 12 times previously, the Falcons lead the series 7-5 and abroad, though, the stats are very different. The Jets have a 100% winning record in regular and postseason matchups played overseas. The Falcons, on the other hand, have only played once internationally before they hosted the Detroit Lions at Wembley. And after leading 21-0 at the half, the Falcons lost that matchup 22-21 in arguably the most exciting London game played to date. So with both teams coming into London with one win under their belt, this is an evenly poised matchup. Will the Falcons finally flex their offensive muscle in 2021, or will it be Zach Wilson and the Jets? If you're not at the game, then catch the action live and on demand, plus more exclusive content from previous London games on NFL Game Pass, now for a new low price. Just head over to nflgamepass.com and sign up. And remember, you can watch every episode from season 2 of the Neil Reynolds Podcast, all for free.
Hi, I'm Bruce Arians, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Welcome back to the Neil Reynolds Podcast and my conversation with Ryan Leaf. Now, in this episode, we've heard Ryan delve deep into his life story from growing up in Montana to realizing his NFL dream. But it quickly turned sour with controversies off the field shaping how things would play out on the field. It would all mean that by the age of 26, the second overall pick from the 1998 NFL draft would retire from the sport he loved. After working so hard to get there, to reach the top and play out the dream of any young player, you would think Ryan walking away from the sport would have been a difficult moment for him. It was quite the opposite.
Yeah, there was a real sense of relief. I was so sick and tired of being beat up, both physically and mentally.
Yep.
And I had developed this real mental illness, a clinical depression, while I was in Seattle, my last stop. and I was having trouble getting out of bed, and I was sad all the time, and I felt incredibly lazy, and I gained a bunch of weight, and I was about to go to training camp. And we have clauses in our contracts about our weights and stuff like that. And it was going to be incredibly embarrassing, and I was going to be fined a ton, and it was going to be reported in the papers, and so fearful around that stuff. And instead of walking into Coach Holmgren's office and telling him all those things, I just quit, because I thought that was the easiest way to deal with it, because I had all the things that made me a success still. The money, the power, the prestige was a bit tarnished, but still incredibly successful in my life is the way I thought. But my name would never go away simply because of who I was drafted alongside. The internet had just started, and because of all the expectation on me and how, you know, how it crashed and burned, you know. And because every April my name gets brought up, you know, you don't want to draft another Ryan Leaf. So how does somebody who cares so much about what other people think deal with that in a positive and healthy way? I didn't know how to. When an opportunity presented itself after that career had ended about 3 months out, an acquaintance of mine offered me some Vicodin when we were at an event where there were Hall of Famers and Super Bowl champions, and where I always felt less than and judged. And I mixed it with the alcohol I was drinking that night, and it did what it's supposed to. It's a painkiller. It killed my pain. This just so happened to be emotional pain now. Didn't make me feel better. Didn't make me feel anything. And I was searching for that, I think, for a long, long time, was just to not feel anything. The failure, the disappointment, the less than, the judgment, the fear, all of that. This pill did exactly what it's supposed to do. It killed my pain. And then for the next 8 years, I ran to that. I tried to find it so I could not feel anything anymore.
You, I guess your rock bottom is when you get arrested, right? For burglary, you go to prison. Yeah.
No? You'd think it would be. But you know, it really wasn't. The bottom for me was like Googling how to kill yourself, you know, and then taking a knife and trying to slit your wrist. That's the bottom. But then going to prison and being there, it still wasn't the bottom. The bottom I've ultimately come to realize is that when you don't get back up, that's the bottom. And right. So when people ask me that question, whether or not I've hit rock bottom, I say no. You know, I didn't get there, and I'm grateful I didn't get there. And it's imperative that you have your own bottom, whatever that looks like. You have to experience it. Like, I can't want something for you. And ultimately, you know, I was guided by something bigger than me, whatever that is, that ultimately carried me to where I'm at right now.
It must have been incredibly hard to hear your name every April. You know, anyone in the media, you get stuff on social media, but not every April. I don't get that. I don't get people telling me I'm the worst presenter that's ever presented NFL, and, you know, always be associated with something. So you're dealing with that. Then you're in prison, and you're in prison for 32 months. And I heard this story, and you can maybe tell me this. You only went outside twice. Yep. And one of those was because you were being the Ryan Leaf sideshow almost. People wanted you to come out. So how, honestly, people can judge what you've been through and all of that, but until no one's ever going to know what that's like, even in prison, to be in prison for 32 months and to go outside twice. Can you tell me about that?
Well, it was in my home state. So I remember the first time I went out, it was because a fellow inmate asked me to come out and play some football with them. They were playing flag football, and they wanted me to be all-time quarterback. And so I did, probably for a couple reasons, probably to inflate my ego and, you know, and to toss it around a little bit. You know, maybe I would come out of my depression a little bit. And it just made things worse, because I started doing it, and then the walkie-talkies of the guards started going off, like, Leafs out here throwing passes, and more guards showed up, and I felt incredibly embarrassed and shameful. Like, this is what I'd become. And I remember walking back to my my cell and thinking, I'm not going outside again. I'm never doing that again. Mm. What's ironic in that story is the guy that asked me to come out came up to my room that night. And he said, man, I just wanted to tell you that like today was my birthday and you gave me the coolest birthday present ever. I got to play catch with an NFL quarterback. And I still thought it was all about me. I couldn't hear that I had done something for somebody else in that moment. And it gave him like joy. Mm-hmm. I still thought about me and my poor situation and all of that. And so much so I didn't go outside, but one more time, the rest of my time there, I didn't do anything. I was miserable.
Now, he may have struggled with his life choices, the very decisions that put Ryan into prison. But his story doesn't end there on a sad note. No, Ryan's journey is one of redemption, where he's picked himself up off the floor to turn things around. So much so, he's now known to UK fans in the NFL as part of our Sky Sports coverage. He's worked himself back into a position where he can make a difference.
I was helped along the way by a ton of people. You know, I'm not here unless a ton of people supported me and had my back, because when I walked out of prison, I had nothing. Like, no one was there. My parents were the only ones, and no money, no job, no prospects. I had this hope, and I had developed this hope in prison because of my roommate in there. He had confronted me one day about how much value that I had, not only to the men in there, but for when I got out. He was an Afghan-Iraqi war veteran, so of course had a ton of perspective. Mm. He wasn't resolute with who he was in there and wanted to be different and thought he saw that for me. And he suggested we go down to the prison library and help prisoners learn how to read who didn't know how to read. And, you know, I've had many of those kind of come to Jesus moments from coaches, mentors, family, and everything like that. And I said, you know, that's not me. How's that going to help me? But I went. I think maybe because the substance had been out of my brain long enough that I was at least willing and open-minded, and I went. Still begrudgingly, I remember walking down the prison hallway in my red jumpsuit, thinking, "This is stupid. This isn't going to help me. Doesn't he know how important I am?" And that's the silliest thing, that a guy in a red jumpsuit in a prison hallway is thinking that he's important still. And I walked into that room where there were men, where you're supposed to not show any vulnerability because that will get you hurt. Be vulnerable. Look at me and say, Brian, I can't read. Can you help me? And I don't think I'd ever seen that or heard that from any man in my life. Growing up in Montana in locker rooms, I never heard somebody say, I'm really hurting here. Can somebody help me? So I had to flip my perspective completely. But also, it doesn't change anything unless I keep doing it. Like, you don't go to the gym one day and the next day you wake up and look at yourself in the mirror and you look like The Rock, right? It's about consistency and it's about showing up. So I kept going back. 2, 3, 4 weeks, a month, 2 months have passed, and I realize I'm sleeping better. I'm more personable. I'm talking to my family. And I knew that it was going to have to be at the center of who I was when I got out, or nothing was going to change. And it was going to have to be about being of service to another human being. So you ask how I changed. It became about other people. It could never be about me again. And what's ironic in all that is that when you make it about somebody else, like, amazing things happen for you.
Opportunities come for you again.
And it's like an oxymoron almost, where you make it about other people and try to be part of the solution, and amazing things happen for you. And you live in a ton of gratitude around that. The family that I've made with my wife to be and my son, things that I never thought I would get to have or accomplish. You know, if you'd have told me the day I walked out of prison that, Ryan, you're going to work for the Disney Corporation, I would have told you are insane. But working at ESPN has been great. The opportunity to work with you and Alex and everybody associated with Sky Sports has been wonderful. And I think a lot of people thought, you know, how football was really toxic for me, but it's also something that gave me everything that I had ever wanted. It's a matter of what I did with that.
Yeah. I was just going to ask you about that, because you went from loving it as a kid, stuffing socks down your t-shirt, to the game kind of hurting you. And now I see it when we were on Sunday. You love it. So yeah. You've gotten all these journey.
Well, I think it's perspective, right? I get that it was my fault, right? The parts that that's where the accountability piece comes in. And I love football. Like Saturdays, you know, I'm up at 6 a.m. watching College Game Day, and then I'm watching football until 11 p.m. at night. And then Sunday morning, I take my kid to baseball. And then I'm locked in with the NFL, either working with you guys or watching games all day, because I do the NFL Rewind show on Sirius XM at night, recapping the day's games. So I love it. I mean, fantastic. I'm 45 years old, and I am just as smitten with football as I have been when I was 4 years old.
That's great. It is great to hear. I've got two more questions, then I'm done. The relationship with Peyton Manning. What was that like, or what has there been one? And I wonder, when you're at your low and Peyton's heading towards the Hall of Fame, was there any resentment? What was the whole dynamic between you and Peyton, not just around 1998, which obviously you guys were the center of the world? They actually brought a press trip. I was on a press trip. I went to the game where you played against Peyton Manning. It was that big that the NFL brought over a contingent of media from the UK. I was one of them at that game at the RCA Dome. But what was it like, not just from 98, but all the way through, any relationship there with Peyton?
Peyton and I have known each other for 26 years now. We both kind of knew where it was heading, and our sports information directors at our schools got us in touch that final year. And we started talking back before there were cell phones. We had to be at home when the phone rang, and I remember picking up the phone headset for the first time and hearing that New Orleans Southern drawl. And I just like covered up the mic and looked over at my friends. I'm like, dude, it's Peyton Manning. And you know what? I just think that dude saw me for who I was then. And like, no matter what transpired the rest of my life, he had an idea of the innocence of Ryan Leaf and our families, because we spent a lot of time together with our families at the Heisman Trophy, at the draft, at a bunch of awards deals. And Olivia and Archie were incredible to my parents, especially during the times that I was struggling a ton. Peyton wrote me while I was in prison. And then, you know, this summer when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, I got an invite. And to your point about being resentful, yeah, he's easily the easiest person I could be resentful around all this, but dude's a good person. He'd be who I'd wish I could have been, right? I know how hard it was, and he made it look easy, and he was successful, and I'm incredibly proud of him. So it was an honor to be there. It was fun to see his family again. We always give Eli a hard time because Eli and my brother are about the same age, and my mom dressed them in, our moms dressed them in outfits at the draft, or not the draft, at the Heisman Trophy, that were, they were like vertical striped shirts with like plaid tie. I mean, it's just awful. It's just awful. I can't wait for when I get a chance to go on the Manning cast here sometime this year, and me and Peyton to roll out those photos of our brothers, from the Heisman Trophy. But, yeah, we're buddies, you know.
Good.
I probably think we're closer buddies than he does. You know, I'll get a return text probably every two out of four texts. So I mean, you know, it is what it is. Incredibly proud of him. Funny thing about all this, we're both 45 year old dads now, working in the broadcasting world, and retired football players. So everything comes full circle.
Yeah. Last question. This is the kicker. You've talked about your career and summed up your career. We just talked about Peyton Manning, who's in the Hall of Fame now. If you'd had your 45-year-old head on your 21-year-old body, that's total fantasy football. I know, that's not life. If you had, do you think you'd have been in the Hall of Fame?
That's slippery slope, because if I hadn't experienced everything that I've experienced, I wouldn't be the person I am. I might just
True.
I might just be a 45-year-old asshole with a couple Super Bowl rings, you know? No one wants to hang out with that guy. So
you won anyway then.
I ended up winning anyway. It just took a different path. Peyton's not a 45-year-old asshole with two Super Bowl rings, though.
Just to be clear. That's
different, you know? He's a good guy with a couple of Super Bowl rings. I like where I'm at. I'm comfortable with the person I see in the mirror every single day. And I never thought I'd be able to like look you in the eye and say I'm grateful for having spent 32 months in prison. I don't recommend it, but I'm grateful for it.
So there you are. That's my conversation with Ryan Leaf. An incredible, sometimes harrowing story. But yeah, good to be working with him now on Sky Sports NFL and to get to know the man. Because when I look at the headlines, you know, before I even knew Ryan, didn't think he was the person that I've got to know. So I'm glad that we've got to know each other. I'm glad that I got to work with him. And I'm glad to bring in producer Gary Hayes. How are you, Gary?
I'm good, Neil. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right, mate. Thank you.
That was a tough episode to edit, a tough one to listen to. I'm not sure what listeners would have thought of it. It just brought me back to some of the subject matter when we did the Scott Pioli episode early in season one, just some of the stuff that Scott was speaking about. And you think about Ryan going through his own challenges. It must have been fitting for him to speak so candidly about it as well, just to be so open and honest.
Yeah, I think he couldn't really get away from some of it. And he just had to own it. You know, just, he was, some of the behavior, boorish behavior when he was, a young player. And it was just very, very honest. And I appreciated his honesty. So, glad we got to tell that story. And I'm glad Ryan's doing a lot better, turn things around. What we got in the mailbag?
Well, we got a question from me as well, actually, if that's all right. So I'll get into that one first because...
All right. From you or for you?
Well, from me to you because... This weekend was, as we record this, we're just doing it on the back of Brady's homecoming to Foxborough. And for people that don't know, when we started recording this podcast, we were doing it in person. That was always the intention. But COVID restrictions and lockdowns have meant we haven't seen each other since we were in Tampa, Neil. And I'm just wondering, when I see you next time, will you give me a hug that is lasts a lot longer than the hug that Belichick gave Brady?
It'll be a tiny bit warmer as well. That was the hug officiated by Frosty the Snowman, I think. What was interesting was from that game, Belichick knows Brady. He had a plan to kind of slow Brady down. That worked. Tom Brady didn't throw a touchdown pass. Look, we know about their divorce. And I think Brady had had enough of playing under Bill Belichick's abrasive style. The reports were that he treated Brady like he was 20 years old, not 40 years old towards the end. It's all been well documented. I think the hug was just expected. You're never going to get much more than that from Bill Belichick. I thought what was interesting, and maybe is being reported a little bit less, was that Bill Belichick then entered the Bucs locker room on his own with no one else after the game. He and Brady went into a private area in that locker room, off to the side of the locker room, and spent 25 minutes together. I thought that was nice. And that's probably a bit of closure for both of them. And that's Belichick's style. He would rather do it. He's not going to give you a show just for a show. You know, I go back to when I interviewed him at midfield in Gillette Stadium, standing on the field, and I was trying to lead him down the path of Tom Brady's a great quarterback. I just wanted him to say those words, and he wouldn't. And he wasn't going to do it just for my sake. And he wasn't going to hug Tom Brady warmly just for the media's sake. He'd rather speak to Tom Brady behind closed doors. And that's what they did.
Maybe he was saying, Tom, come back. All is forgiven. Forget Bruce.
Maybe. Yeah. You know I'm a better night out than Bruce Arians.
Oh, I doubt that one. Right, let's get into the real reason we're here. So we've got a question from Storm 1892. I do ask people to give us their real names, but clearly Storm 1892 disobeyed me.
That's when Storm was born.
Right. Well, he's got a Newcastle United FC badge on his as his avatar
on
Newcastle Twitter.
So were born.
Yeah, he's clearly a Geordie. So, okay. Or maybe a Macum. I've said that to offend him now because he didn't give us his real name.
Don't wind him up.
So Storm 1892 from Sunderland asks, or says, Neil, I have loved the sport of American football since the 80s. And back in those days, Roger Craig was a big part of the 49ers team and he won 3 Super Bowls and was the first player to have 1,000 receiving and rushing yards in the same season. So why do you think he is not in the Hall of Fame? And in your opinion, should he be?
That is a good question, Storm Pet. See what I did there, Gary? Getting into the lingo. Our American listeners are like, what the heck is going on right now? I think it's a very tough, it's a very tricky one, this one. I was just looking at the numbers and I remember the same as Storm. I remember, you know, Roger Craig being an integral part of those 49ers teams. You know, could you picture that 49ers team that won the Super Bowl in the 84 season without Roger Craig there? And you can't. And then the 85 season, he goes over 1,000 rushing, 1,000 receiving. It's Super Bowl 19, 3 touchdowns against the Dolphins. He kind of changed the game a little bit with Bill Walsh. It was the short passes to the running back became an extension of the running game, which we see so much now. So he was ahead of his time. Highest step in. You know, you wouldn't want to tackle him because you get a face full of knee. But the numbers aren't spectacular. He only had 3 1,000-yard seasons. He had 8,189 rushing yards. But then he did have 566 catches, nearly 5,000 yards, and another 17 touchdowns. He was in the all-decades team of the 80s. He was a 3-time Super Bowl winner, a 4-time Pro Bowler. So initially, I'm looking at the numbers and saying it's not good enough to get you there. But I think I always say there's 3 components to being in the Hall of Fame. Well, maybe 4. 1 is the numbers. 2 is, did you win championships? And these are not in any order, because I don't think, you know, lots of great players never won a championship. He won 3 of them. Were you considered one of the best of your generation? And he was in the all decades team. And number 4 would be, I guess, did you impact the game? Did you change the game? Were you, you know, were you the best receiver on the sidelines? Were you the most productive quarterback in 2-minute drills or whatever it may be? So I think Roger Craig should be in, because I think he ticks a lot of those boxes. The only last one I would say, and this is going to go counter to everything I've just said, they always say, can you tell the story of professional football without this person? And if you can, then they shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. And I think there's a lot more running backs that you would mention in the history of football before you'd mention Roger Craig. So I'm kind of on the fence. I can see why he hasn't, but I think he should. That's a long answer. Crikey.
Well, with that in mind, thinking of Hall of Famers, do you think you can tell the story of the NFL without Tom Brady?
No, absolutely not.
I was just being an idiot.
You're being serious.
No, I've been an idiot because I know, like, obviously Christ. he can't become a Hall of Famer yet. But I know when people talk about GOAT and everything else, yeah, I just thought I'd be contrary. Yes.
I like it.
That's my style, right?
Well done. Yeah, you gave it a good go. But I like those sort of questions when we dig into the history of it, because I'm kind of with Storm. You know, you think back to the 49ers and well, actually there's a good indicator. I think back to the 49ers, I think Joe Montana, Jerry Rice, Bill Walsh, then I think Roger Craig. So, I mean, how deep do you want to go for Hall of Famers on a team? But, you know, he was a key player and a good one. So I like those kind of questions. Keep them coming.
So next week, Neil, what have you got for
us? Not sure. Magical Mystery Tour. So I've got some guests that are going to be in. There'll be some big names in around the London games. So I'm going to go fishing. So I'm not literally going fishing. I'm going to go fishing for a guest.
Fitz has left his rods back in Arizona.
Yeah. I've been fishing before, but not successfully. Stay tuned, dear listener, because we will have another episode of the Neil Reynolds podcast next week. I think I have an idea who it'll be. And it's another uplifting, and this is an inspirational story, which is the kind of things we want to tell. So, stay tuned. Check in next time. Thanks to you, Gary. And bye for now, everybody. Reynolds podcast. This episode was hosted by myself, Neil Reynolds, while Gary Hayes is our producer. Gary and I have also written this series together. Our consultant producers are Kerry Levy, Nick Lapworth, and Neil Pacchietto. Matt Alabaster is responsible for all of our artwork, including the graphics and videos across our social media channels. Taylor Hayes mixed this episode and also composed our theme music. If you'd like to keep up to date with everything we're doing throughout the season, then please follow us on Twitter and Instagram at the NR Podcast. My personal account is also at Neil Reynolds NFL. If you've enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear more like it, then visit highway61.media. That's HWY61.media. Please tell your friends about the podcast, help spread the word. Better still, leave us a rating and a review wherever you're listening. This has been another Highway 61 production for the Reynolds Podcast Network.